Hello, this is UCL Uncovering Politics, and today we're focusing on violent protest. Can it ever be morally justified? Hello, my name is Alan Rennick, and welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics, the podcast of the School of Public Policy and Department of Political Science at University College London. The coming week sees the first anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. His killing by a white police officer in the American city of Minneapolis sparked a global wave of protests. The vast majority of these were peaceful, but some were not. It's estimated that in the United States, acts of rioting, arson, and looting in the weeks that followed caused over $1 billion worth of damage, the highest recorded damage from civil disorder in US history. So can such violent protests ever be justified? Much public and political opinion says no. Here in the UK, even last year's toppling of the inanimate statue of a 17th century slave trader was condemned across much of the political spectrum. But one of our colleagues here in the UCL Department of Political Science argues differently. Dr. Avia Pasternak, who is Associate Professor in Political Theory here, argues that sometimes violent protests are morally justified. And I'm delighted to say that Avia joins me now to discuss her analysis. Avia, welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics. And let's start with a little bit of background. I introduced our conversation there with a reference to the Black Lives Matter protests over the past year. But you actually started working on this topic well before that. What led you to write about this topic, the ethics of violent protest?
Thanks, Alan, and it's a pleasure to be here. So yes, I started working on this project probably about 10 years ago, and actually the protest that sparked my interest in it were the 2011, what was then called the London riots. I was living at London at the time in one of the areas that was affected by these protests. So we have seen window shops smashed, and there was a general atmosphere of fear and discomfort about what's going to happen in overnight for the residents of the neighborhood. And in the aftermath of that, I had I met with our colleagues, a political theory group at UCL, and I remember having a long chat with one of my colleagues, Dr. Emily McTernan, where we discussed what happened, and I was describing these events in a rather condemning tone. And Emily disagreed with me, and she actually thought that, you know, there's more to it, to the picture. And I became very intrigued about how different our initial responses to that were. And I thought, well, this is something that's really worth exploring, and I want to test myself. I want to test why did I feel like that, and also was that the appropriate response? So that's what sparked my interest in this topic in general.
Hmm. So it's a common view that violent protests in democracies are not permissible. Now you take issue with that, I guess. Why do you do so?
It's an interesting question of why. And I think one of the exploring my own response to these original protests of 2011, and generally speaking, the public response to these incidents, I think there's certainly an imbalance in the type of agents that are involved in this. So we usually have often the people who resort to violent protests of the type we will be talking about are people who are oppressed people, marginalized members of a society, who have long been suffering from various types of rights deprivation, of political marginalization, of economic marginalization. And then the responses to them, the very harsh responses, such as you described, and there are plenty of examples for that. We can think about President Trump calling the recent protesters as just thugs and terrorists, or Prime Minister Cameron at the time was referring them to just the common garden thieving and looting. So the responses are from the elite, and the responses are always condemning, and they're always the elite, the establishment that condemns those the have-nots, for when they themselves resort to violent means, when often those who are resort to violent means feel that for a long time they themselves have faced violence from the hand of the state. So I had a feeling that there is some kind of an imbalance here where we are very comfortable in condemning people against the violence that they use against, but we are not necessarily paying enough attention to the circumstances under which they felt that the resort to violence is justified.
So you have a kind of starting hunch there. And you, of course, are a political theorist. How do you get from a hunch to some serious political theory on this question?
So then I was thinking, okay, so there's a certain hunch here that the violence might be justified. And I was thinking to myself, okay, so where are the, and I was starting to look for literature on this. And interestingly, there was very, very little literature on the ethics of violence in protests. So people just did not touch this topic. And so I couldn't find anything to help me there in the existing literature. So I'm thinking, okay, so when do we actually think about conditions under which violence is justified? And there is actually very rich literature on the question of the justification of violence in other contexts, so in the context of self-defense, and also perhaps closer, in my view, to the topic that we are interested in the context of a just war theory. So political theorists have spent many hours, a lot of ink has been spilled on the question of whether when is the resort to collective violence of war is justified. And there's deep debates on that. And I thought, well, we can take those debates and do something that hasn't been done before. And so I was thinking, what do these debates, the conditions that have been specified in the ethics of self-defense and just war, can tell us about the conditions of violent protesters in democracies? And can the conditions that we think allow for violence in these contexts be applied to the case of political protest? So in a way, I'm suggesting in the project, the general methodological suggestion of the project is that we can use the ethics of self-defense in order to assess the moral permissibility of the acts of violent protesters.
So just before we get into the ethics of self-defense and what's been written on that, you said a moment ago that very little has been written about the ethics of violent protest, which I guess might surprise quite a lot of people, because the topic of civil disobedience is one of the kind of classic topics of political theory that's been written about for centuries. Does that not help us understand violent protest?
You're absolutely right that civil disobedience has been a topic of much interest to political theorists. However, perhaps unfortunately, it has been very much dominated, at least in Western political thought. And I want to emphasize that everything that I say here about that literature is really about Anglo-American political thought, which is the literature I engage in. That literature on civil disobedience has been very much dominated by the starting point, if you like, that was given by John Rawls in his analysis of civil disobedience in a theory of justice, where John Rawls has characterized civil disobedience as having to comply with certain conditions. And one of these conditions was nonviolence and civility. And that has been taken as a given that when we talk about civil disobedience, we talk about illegal protest, but one that is civil and one that is nonviolent and one that where the protesters are submitting themselves to punishment. They do not resist arrest, they do not resist punishment. And indeed, you can think about kind of major campaigns of civil disobedience in the real world that have complied with these requirements. So perhaps the most a celebrated example is the civil rights movements in the US in the 1960s, where we can see the image of people doing sit-ins and people marching nonviolently and in fact being attacked themselves by the police, but yet sticking to the nonviolence on a principled level. The protests I'm interested in violate that rule from the outset. So they are violent in the sense that they target property, they target police officers, they resist arrest, they clash with police, they chant, they're very uncivil in the words that they use and the graffiti that they spray. So they don't really fit in that classic model of civil disobedience. And for that reason, they've just been left outside that debate so far.
So interesting when you see that, you know, there's a really important phenomenon in the world and somehow we in academia haven't quite engaged with it. Do you have thoughts on why political theory has left this huge gap for such a long time?
It's a good question. I think there are various reasons to that. I think that perhaps it's a difficult topic to think about because, you know, our knee-jerk reaction, I think, is to be worried about violence and to be seeing violence as something that is we ought not be engaged in a process of justifying it. I think that it is also probably related to what I said earlier about the power balance. So I think that typically people, academics or philosophers, are at a certain socioeconomic level where attempts to disturb the status quo in that way, they find them threatening and frightening. So I think that there is therefore a natural, I think, kind of bias towards being reserved about these phenomena and preferring not to engage in it in a direct way. But it's a good question.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. So your argument is that we, in order to analyze violent protests, we should use the ethics of self-defense and just war. Can you tell us a little bit about that framework?
Yeah, so that framework has typically been, has been tailored to kind of the simple scenarios where a person, it can be a person, it can be a state, it can be a nation, face an unjust aggressor, right? So you can imagine in the one-on-one scenario where you are facing, I don't know, an aggressor that threatens you with a gun to tell you your money or your life. Or you can imagine a nation that is facing an unjust invasion. And this kind of direct, immediate threat, and that literature seeks to identify the conditions under which you may permissibly respond in violence yourself, and in which, and what, you know, and what type and what level of violence you may engage in when you face this kind of threat. And again, I'm going to be very, very broad here, but traditionally, the familiar three constraints that we have on permissive violence in self-defense, there are three such conditions. The first one is the necessity condition. So the assumption is that if you resort to violence, it must be that you have no other choice, right? So that the harm that you are intending to inflict is basically that's the least harmful option, that alternative that you have out of the options. So in my example of a person that is pointing a gun at you and saying your money or your life, if, for example, there is an option for you to hide or to shoot them in the leg rather than in the head, then of course we think that you ought to do the least harmful option, right? So that's kind of the necessity condition. The second condition is the effectiveness or success condition that requires that if you engage in violence, then you have to have a reasonable grounds to think that the engagement in violence is going to be effective. There's no point in engaging in war if you know from the outset that there's no chance that you're going to achieve anything in it. And the third condition is that of proportionality. And here the basic thought is that there should become some kind of fit between the harm that you're going to inflict in order to defend yourself from the attack and the harm that you're trying to avert. So if, for example, Alan, I threatened you that I'm going to grab your glasses and break them, that's unjustified, but it would seem a bit disproportionate if in response you took out your gun and shot me, right? Because the harm of losing your glasses, yes, it's unpleasant, but it probably doesn't justify killing the attacker. So we just think this response is not proportionate. So all of these conditions, basically, the common starting point for them is that we should avoid violence if we can. Violence is unjustified unless we think it's necessary. It has a reasonable chance of success. And the harm we inflict on it is proportionate to the harm that we are going to prevent.
Okay. So if we try to apply those three conditions to the case of a violent protest. So I guess start off with the necessity condition. Now, we're talking particularly here, aren't we, about violent protest in democratic states. And someone might think that, well, in a democracy, we can vote, we can join a pressure group, we can join a non-violent protest, we can do all sorts of things. There are all sorts of ways in which we can express ourselves and seek to advance our views and our interests. So many people might think, well, how can it be that violent protest is necessary in order to pursue your objectives within a democratic system?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think exactly the type of objections that we have to, or reservations we have from political violence, we can phrase them along concerns about necessity, about effectiveness, and about proportionality. So perhaps we can, in order to start answering this question, we need to take a step back and think for a moment about the type of circumstances that we are facing in democratic societies. And here, my work sits together with other work in contemporary political theory, which is part of the non-ideal turn in political theory. So for many years, as I already mentioned earlier, political theory have been engaged in the Rawlsian project of identifying what the ideal states, the just state, would look like. It's a worthy project. It's an important project. It is an action-guiding project. However, many political theorists in recent years felt that we've a little bit lost the way, because we're so concerned with ideal theory that we are not actually doing political theory for societies as we know them. So let's think about societies as we know them. Societies as we know them, and here I'm talking about even advanced liberal democracies like the UK, like France, like the US, they have democratic components, but they are very far from the ideal democracy that Rawls describes. So I see these societies as marred by very serious injustices. Injustices that involve, sometimes they are racial, they're also along racial lines, sometimes they're less along racial lines, but in many of them there are along racial lines, very serious discrimination, marginalization, and denial of what many of us would think are basic rights of portions of the populations. So we're thinking, for example, if you think about circumstances of the inner city ghetto in the US, where the life expectancy, the access to health, to education, to what any, you know, to a decent standard of living are limited from very early age to people who live there. And we also have the whole kind of racial background against it. And we see not that different conditions in parts of the UK and in areas of France. So this is a setup against which we are engaging with. And so first of all, I want to emphasize that I interpret violent protest as protest that is self-defensive in that respect. It is protest that is directed at these type of injustices. It is often, almost always, sparked by incidents of police violence. And that was the case of the 2011 London protests. That was the case of the recent protests in the US. It always sparked by the case of police violence. But this police violence is in a certain context. It's not an isolated incident. It's an incident where the relationship between the police and these communities are already fraught with violence and brutality and indiscriminate treatment. And that treatment in itself is a symbol an expression of a general disrespect that the state has towards portions of its populations. Now, against this background, we can also have a different picture about the question that you've asked me about the necessity of the resort to violent protest. Because it is true that for many citizens in democratic states like those, there are other means to resort to. There are the ability to participate effectively in the traditional political process and even in campaigns of civil disobedience. So those channels of engagement are available. But I think that it can be the case that populations who for decades have been oppressed by their states feel themselves as politically marginalized, as alienated from the political protest, they don't feel that any of the existing parties, the mainstream parties, do actually care for their interests or represent them. And they have good reasons to think that, right? So the evidence speak on their behalf. So their sense is that the normal channels of political participations are just not open to them. Even if they try to make noise, no one is listening to them. They try to organize a demonstration, that demonstration will not have the effect. They don't have the connections. They don't have the resources. They don't have the political capital to engage in that type of effective protest. And I think that when we look at real-world democracies and the bleak circumstances under which portions of the population find themselves, it seems that the necessity condition, we become more open to the idea that the necessity condition perhaps has actually been satisfied. Think about all the protests that have been done in the US against police violence. and how little they've actually achieved so far. And I can understand why someone feels like, well, I have exhausted all other options.
And I guess that takes us on to the second criterion, the effectiveness criterion. Is there evidence that violent protests work?
This is a good question. And the answer is, as always in political science, yes and no, or perhaps in this case, we should say no and yes. There is a lot of recent work on the effectiveness of violent protests by political scientists. And the most cited, the most celebrated and cited works on this, for example, the work by Erica Chenworth and Maria Stephan, or the work of Omar Wassol from Princeton, suggests that a resort to violence is not effective in bringing about change in public policy. So their study suggests that there's two problems with the resort to violence. One is that it's creates both voters and policymakers turn against they feel that they are coerced and they turn against, they turn to law and order policies, which are often in tension with social justice goals. And also that violent protest movements have harder time of recruiting the type of citizens that they need in order to get effectiveness. So people just don't want to associate themselves with violent protests. And I think this is important. And of course, we should bear that in mind. However, I don't think reading that literature, I think that we can raise some questions about the effectiveness condition. And I want to raise two questions. First of all, I think that there's been a lot of focus on the US in this respect, like a lot of political science. And the US is an example with, you know, it's unique in its own ways. But the evidence from Europe, for example, suggests that those connections between violent protests and policymakers can be different. So, for example, in France, violent protest has actually been more effective than in the US. In the UK, the picture is more mixed. So my point is that we shouldn't think that what happens in the US, we should draw conclusions about what happens anywhere, everywhere else. The second thing I want to say is that we should think about what do we mean by violent protests. So, for example, the very cited database of Chenworth and Stephan looks at violent protests, but type of violence that are fairly high. Okay, so they're thinking about terrorist campaigns, armed resistance. We have to remember that the violence we're talking about in protest is of a much lower level, right? So we are talking here about episodes, short episodes, outbursts of violence that are mainly targeting private and public property. And there isn't kind of organized resistance, using of lethal weapons and so on and so forth. That's not the type of violence that I'm interested in. And there's less research on the effectiveness of that type of protest. And the third thing I will say quickly is that we should also consider what do we mean by effectiveness. So there is the instrumental effectiveness of impacting directly policymakers, but perhaps we also want to think a little bit more broadly about the goals of the protesters. For example, the goal of defying the political order and expressing your anger and resentment at it. We might think that this is a goal that is effectively achieved by political protests, violent protests, and perhaps less so by civil protests that are kind of expressing respect for the law. And we might think that people who are regularly oppressed by the state have a strong interest and a right in expressing defiance against the political order that disrespects them. So if you kind of expand the question of what do we want to, what does violent protest aim to achieve and what is the value of these goals, then perhaps we shouldn't be so narrowly focused on how policymakers respond to the protest. So none of this suggests that all violent protest is permissible, but it suggests that the picture, the reality is more complex, and there can be circumstances where the resort to violent protest can meet the effectiveness test.
Okay, so that's necessity and effectiveness, the first two criteria. The third one is proportionality. And presumably the proportionality principle implies that some forms of violent protest are easier to justify than others.
Yes, I think so. And I think proportionality is the condition in self-defense theory that has probably received the most attention, because it's the one that raises the most interesting philosophical question. How, as I said earlier, The basic idea is that the harm that you inflict in self-defense should be some kind of a fit to the harm that you seek to avoid, to prevent in your actions. But how do we actually conceptualize that fit? And what factors play a role here is an important question. So I want to mention two factors out of many factors that I think play a role here. They're not the only factors. One is the type of harm that you target, that the protesters target. And here I think we can broadly distinguish between targeting property versus targeting life and limb. And I think the general agreement we have is that the damage to property is a less severe harm than targeting life and limb. Again, these are broad distinction. And even with these categories, you might think that there's an important difference between the harm that is resulted from targeting private property, such as people's apartments or people's shops, versus the harm that is resulted from targeting public property, such as police stations or government buildings and so on and so forth, right? So here too, we might think the distinction. Some people also think that there might be a distinction between targeting police officers or public officials and targeting fellow citizens. The other distinction that is relevant here when we think about proportionality is who are the agents that are being harmed. And here I think that there is, drawing on existing work, I think we should distinguish between harm that is inflicted on people who are themselves responsible for the original attack, the unjust attack, and harm that is inflicted on third parties or bystanders. So in my original, just to kind of tease our intuitions about that, in my original simple example where a person is facing an unjustified attacker, we might think that an unjustified attacker who threatens somebody else's life, it seems proportionate that they themselves will be subject to a similar level of harm in response. So it seems proportionate that if I have to kill them in order to save myself, that seems like that there's a fit. On the other hand, if the only way that I can defend myself from that unjustified attacker is grabbing, I don't know, a child that's just passed by in the street and using that child as a shield against myself, I think most of us would think that is unjustified, right? So that third parties, we shouldn't, you know, the harms that they might be liable to in order to defend myself are much, much lower than that of a unjustified attacker. So that, of course, bears on the question of violent protest. If we think that there are some agents who share responsibility, who perhaps share the blame for the conditions under which the protesters find themselves, then we might think that there's a higher level of harm that they are liable to. On the other hand, we might share the intuition that those people who don't share any such responsibility, perhaps fellow oppressed citizens, there's much harder to justify the harm that is done to that they may incur.
And I guess that leads on to all sorts of big questions, but not necessarily ones that we have time to go into any detail on now, about whether there can be group responsibility. So whom can we hold responsible in this kind of calculus?
Absolutely. And my own view, and this is a controversial view, but my own view is that we can talk about group responsibility. And my own view is that we can talk about the responsibility of the state as an agent. I think that people... This is commonly shared intuition that the state itself, we can blame the state, we can be angry with the state for the way it's treating us, and that I think that people who are serving within the state could sometimes be liable in light of that group responsibility, part of that organization that they are part of. Again, I want to emphasize that there's a lot of carefully crafted distinctions that need to be drawn here, and which I do in the paper. So I'm just giving you the general framework, and we need, of course, to be carefully investigate the moral position of different actors in different circumstances.
Yeah, so I guess some people might be listening to this thinking, okay, that sounds like a very clear and very elegant theory, and a good way for theorists in ivory towers to think about these things. But if we're imagining someone on the streets, someone contemplating engaging in rioting, it's not really plausible to imagine that they're going to engage in this sort of cost-benefit analysis of working out, you know, do I really need to do this? Is there some other way that I can get my aims more effectively? Is it actually going to work or not? I mean, in the reality of a political riot, this is just not how people are going to be thinking. And I suppose that might lead people on to the further thought that, well, maybe therefore we just shouldn't think that the context of political rioting is one that we want to think is defensible, because that is not a context in which the sort of thinking that you've just laid out is actually going to take place.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So I want, before I answer the question, I just want to say that you use the term political rioting here, and I just want to clarify what this term means. So this is indeed the term that I myself have used to explain this, to describe the phenomena that I'm talking about. So it's basically the type of a group violence that we see in the streets, but one that has a political motive. It's a form of protest. So I've used I use the term of political rioting to describe this, and I want to use it in a neutral sense, right? So I don't describe it as a good or a bad phenomenon. I think it can be good. I think it can be bad. I've moved away from this concept in more recent word because I think that the term rioting is actually now become a condemnatory concept almost by definition. So I use the term violent protest, but I think we mean the same thing. And to your question, so I want to say two things. First of all, it is not entirely true that people who engage in violent protests don't have these questions in mind. So when we look at real-world violent protest, we do actually see that people are discriminatory in their behavior. And there are certain crowd norms that develop. There are descriptions of people who specifically target this kind of property because they have reasons why they think the person who owns this property is in some way complicit in the injustice, but they wouldn't target other type of other property or other individuals. And there are within the protest, we can hear also people condemning each other. No, we don't do this. This is something else. So the question about, I want to emphasize that indeed some protesters, and I'm not trying to kind of create here a rosy picture of protesters. Some protesters are indeed carried away and are doing this for fun and actually don't have these kind of considerations in mind. But at least some protesters and the ones that are politically motivated have those questions at the back of their mind. And if that's the case, and I think that as political theorists, it is our responsibility to engage with these type of questions and to provide some answers to these questions about what type of violence can be permissible. Now, I'm not here as suggesting that, you know, that people will necessarily follow these rules to exactly, but I think we do need to think with them together about what are the ethics as a general line that should guide the type of protest, and maybe we want to see more of that type of engagement in actual protests.
I wish we had time for me to ask you more. I've got all sorts of further questions that I'm eager to get into, but we'll just have to have you back at some point in the future. But Avia, thank you so much. That has really been a very illuminating discussion. And you can find out more about Avia Pasternak's article. Indeed, you can find the article itself. It's called Political Rioting, A Moral Assessment, and it's in the journal Philosophy and Public Affairs. Full details are in the show notes for this episode. We will be back next week. I'm not sure, to be honest, what the topic will be. It'll be a surprise, but you can be confident that it will stimulate the mind. So remember to make sure you don't miss out on that or other future episodes of UCL Uncovering Politics. All you need to do is subscribe. You can do so on Apple, Spotify, or whatever podcast provider you use. I'm Alan Rennick. Our producer is Abby Turner. Our theme music is written and performed by John Mann. This has been UCL Uncovering Politics. Thank you for listening.